First of all, I need to point out that the choir said, "We've got your back." And there we go. So thank you, choir. Also, I thought about going rogue this morning. You can let Jared know that. But then I thought, when I was a teacher and I would leave sub plans, and it was so annoying if they didn't follow the sub plans. So let him know I followed the sub plans today and did what he asked, left what he left for us. I should also add that it's incredibly difficult to read aloud words that when you read them were incredibly convicting of your own struggles and your own issues in life. And so I hope that this morning you can hear these words and that they will be a peace and conviction to you. We're framing the next several weeks of sermons with the themes of mistaken identity. If you search online for literature and movies that trade on this theme of mistaken identity, you'll find hundreds of examples. And I know this to be true because I've seen Jared on his computer reading thousands of movies that have mistaken identity as their theme. On the highbrow end of things, we could talk about Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. Sidney Carton, who happens to look like Charles Darnay, surprises us by swapping places with him in prison and going to the guillotine in his place. Or we could talk about classic movies like Hitchcock's Vertigo or North by Northwest, both of which trade on the theme of mistaken identity. But for today, let's aim a little lower. Let's talk about the 2010 non-Oscar winning or nominated Date Night, starring Steve Carell and Tina Fey, as an ordinary married couple, Phil and Claire Foster. Now, if you haven't seen this movie, which I know you're gonna go out and rent right now, as soon as we're done, the Fosters are a boring married couple living in suburban New Jersey with young children. I should add, boring because they both work and have children, so let's make that clear. Trying to rekindle some magic, they decide to go into New York City to a very trendy restaurant, making reservations, making plans. But of course, as happens, they arrive late, miss their reservation, and they are not allowed in. So when they repeatedly hear a call for someone named Triple Horns, Party of Two, Triple Horns, Party of Two, and no one shows up, they pretend to be the Triple Horns and grab the reservation. Well, this is all well and good until two mobsters show up to reclaim the money that the Triple Horns have stolen from the mob. So the rest of the movie involves this couple being mistaken for the Triple Horns and trying to outrun and avoid being killed by the mob. So a real edge of your seat thriller. Go rent that this afternoon. Why do so many stories and books and movies and things that we read in life talk about characters trapped in a life that's not really theirs, pretending to be someone they're not? We relate to these stories because they get in touch with that persistent problem in our lives. Much of the time, we walk around with a distorted view of who we are. We pretend to be someone we're not, and we get trapped in stories that we thought might make our lives better. Jesus found the central themes that defined his life by reading scripture deeply and allowing the prophets to shape his imagination and his outlook on life. I want to propose to you that it's no different for us. I don't mean that we're Jesus. No, we need baptism for the washing away of our sin, and Jesus didn't. But I do mean that we won't ever figure out how to live unless we open ourselves to the shaping power of Scripture's stories. Baptism is one of those stories that gives shape to our lives. Like Jesus, we are baptized to mark the beginning of a journey. Always the beginning. Whether we're baptized as infants and later confirmed as disciples, or baptized in our teenage years, or as adults, baptism always marks the doorway into a new path, a new way forward. It is a sign that we are learning to understand our lives within the context of stories that the Gospels tell us about Jesus from Nazareth. When our lives are shaped by the stories of baptism, we begin attending to themes of power and leadership in new and different ways. The Spirit that descends and alights upon us as a gift has a strange new power that enables us to live in new ways. It opens to us the possibilities of powerful leadership. The leaders that we ordained today and installed today, which, by the way, this is one of my favorite services that we do to watch everyone come forward. I'm always very touched by that. These are people living out their baptism by the power of the Spirit, moving into that leadership. And while all of us play different roles, the power of that baptism is available to everyone. Our reading from Isaiah invites us into the old stories and images that flowed through Jesus' life and heart. In Isaiah chapters 40 to 55, there are four servant songs. This is the first of those servant songs, the reading we had this morning. God speaks directly. Here is my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. Who is this servant? Is the servant Israel? Is the servant the next kingly leader of Israel? Is it another king like the Persian King Darius, who will help deliver Israel from its exile in Babylon? Is the servant left unnamed and ambiguous on purpose, suggesting that anyone at any time can become God's servant by shaping their lives according to his call for mercy and justice? We can't know for sure. What we do know is that this passage is part of what Bible scholars refer to as Second Isaiah. The book of Isaiah, as we have it now, is stitched together from at least three different sections, written at different times by different people in different circumstances. Second Isaiah, chapters 40 to 55, was written near the end of Israel's captivity in Babylon. Babylon was losing ground to the rising empire of Persia, and before long, Persian rule would allow the Jews from Babylon to travel back to their homeland. In that difficult moment, at the end of a period of distress, a word of hope comes. Does that sound familiar? We do not know the identity of the servant, but God declares that a new thing is about to happen, something unexpected and unforeseen, and it will come about through the activity of a servant. So what will this servant do? How will this servant use this strange and surprising power of the Spirit that comes from God's delight? So there are four things. First, notice that the servant is identified completely in terms of God's favor. The servant is upheld by God, chosen by God, the one in whom God delights. I love that phrase, God delights. So much of what we do is driven by fear, a feeling of worthlessness, or an attempt to avoid shame at all costs. Isaiah's servant doesn't live this way. This life has its strength from seeing itself in the framework of God's delight in the servant. Second, this servant is powerful without drawing attention to itself. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. This is a new kind of power that can be quiet or even unnoticed. Third, this servant is powerful primarily for acts of mercy and healing. A bruised reed he will not break, a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. I remember hearing those voices as a child and not understanding what they meant. A broken reed, a smoldering wick. Those things that are already damaged in some way, hurting. This is a new kind of power that does not need to diminish others or demean others. It is not competitive, and it does not trade on notions of winning or success. Fourth, this servant doesn't live in the cramped little space of self-concern or self-protection, not worried about what's happening to the servant. The servant is connected to the good of the whole world. In verses 3 and 4, it says, "In faithfulness, he will bring forth justice. He will not falter or be discouraged till he establishes justice on earth." This servant is good news for all who are in distress. God will make this servant a light to the Gentiles, in verses 6 and 7, to open eyes that are blind, to free captives that are in prison, and to release from the dungeons those who sit in darkness. Now, you will have to decide what to do with this reading from Isaiah based on this. Is it a dusty old song? Is it an antiquated and irrelevant text from a faraway people very unlike us? Is it flowery poetry that we can dismiss as having no claim on us? Before you answer, you should know that Jesus took these servant songs from Isaiah as his defining life script. He let these songs give shape to his life. He let these songs organize the way he lived. We can witness this from the scene at his baptism. When he was 30 years of age, Jesus went with the crowds out into the Jordan River. As he walked into the water and asked John to baptize him, he did not seek baptism like we do because he was living a distorted life in need of redirection. He was there because he was taking up the public role of Isaiah's servant. The scriptures he had read in Isaiah that he had heard all his life, he was deciding to be a servant of that sort. When he emerges from the water, God's Spirit descends and alights upon him as a dove, and God's voice speaks from heaven. This is my Son, whom I love, with him I am well pleased. Here is Isaiah's servant, the one in whom God delights. Now let's get to the heart of the matter for you and me. Jesus' baptism was the beginning of public ministry, inviting ordinary people like you and me into a deep and life-changing friendship with him and with other disciples. Now we are faced with the crisis. Will we find our truest life within the stories of Jesus and Isaiah? Or will we choose to live by another story? Will we persist in our various mistaken identities that distort who we are? Or will we open ourselves to find a new kind of life that is organized and inspired by a new kind of power? So in light of Isaiah's song and in Jesus' way of life, I would like to name a few of the mistaken identities we sometimes assume, identities that trap us and rob us of the real power available to us. First, our real power is not showy power. So I invite you to lay down the need for others to notice you and what you do. It will be a real blessing to embark on a life that isn't tethered to a secret desire to draw attention to myself. I like that, to embark on a life that isn't tethered to that. As Jesus teaches, just commit your life to consistent, quiet goodness. Find contentment and joy in the small, ordinary acts of care for others, because it is the love that no one sees that pleases God most deeply. Second, our real power eludes us when we focus on winning and succeeding and avoiding pain and failure at all cost. Life is not a competition. I'm going to repeat that mainly for myself. Life is not a competition. Real power is the power to attend to those who feel left out, left behind, neglected, and harmed by our success-oriented society. Our true power comes to us in the mercy that attends to others in their pain and in their distress. Those who work hardest to appear powerful are usually the most fragile and afraid. Have you found this true in your own life with leaders that you've been around? Those connected to real power are comfortable with the bruised reeds and the smoldering wicks. Third, real power is never the power that comes from identifying my team of people against some other group. My life does not get its energy by drawing narrow and selfish boundaries around myself. Rather, I am chosen and called to expand the scope of my concern to match God's all-embracing love. When Syrian families are bombed, when children in Flint, Michigan are poisoned by their drinking water, when those with disabilities are harmed or bullied, I can respond by feeling solidarity and empathy instead of a weary shrug of indifference. I can begin to see all others as brothers and sisters, and even potential friends. And I know that this can be overwhelming given the magnitude of these kinds of issues that exist in our daily life. I would encourage you to choose those areas where you can make a difference, where you can show love, where you can show compassion. Fourth, I cannot live in the power of God that makes available when I spend my energy attending to every voice that shouts for my attention. I cannot let the values and expectations of others keep me guessing about the meaning and purpose of my life. In the midst of those clamoring, shrieking voices that come to me through parents and friends, magazine ads, television commercials, I can hear another different voice. I can hear the voice of God's delight in me, right now, who I am, where I am, God's delight in me. I can see myself as the wounded, vulnerable, fragile life that God blesses and comforts and heals. Here in the beginning of a new year, many of us are weary of resolutions and goal setting. We've had enough of that. Others of us will reach for the stars and set such unrealistic goals that we're almost sure to fail before we begin, like January 7th. All of us enter this year not quite sure how to feel about our political differences. We know there will be changes. We're just not sure what's coming. Regardless, we want our lives to feel like an exercise in friendship and joy instead of an ongoing war and arguments. Maybe what we need more than anything is simply permission to lay down some of the stories we've been telling about ourselves. Maybe what we need this year is the good news that our lives are powerful because we're connected through baptism to Jesus' way of life. It may be quiet, it may be ordinary, but at least it won't trap us in the prison of a mistaken identity.